Hello and welcome to Inside Education. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. You'll find a link to over 170 previous Inside Education programs on my website, seandelaney.com, under the Podcasts tab. Think for a minute about the following questions. Is spending on education a good investment for a country? How much should teachers be paid? Is it better to spend money on small classes and more teachers, or fewer teachers working in larger classes? There are various ways to answer such questions. One of them is using an economics lens. And this week I'm delighted to be speaking to a leader in answering education questions using economics. He is Professor Eric Hanushek from Stanford University in the United States. He is a distinguished graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and completed his PhD in economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He served in the US Air Force from 1965 until 1974. He's interested in topics such as teacher quality, high-stakes accountability, equity and efficiency in school finance, and class size. He has done pioneering work in the United States in measuring teacher quality by looking at how students' achievement grows. I met up with Professor Hanushek recently on the fringes of an education conference in the United States, and I began by noting that in an article he wrote about students' achievement on international tests between 1995 and 2009, Ireland's performance had declined, albeit by a small amount. I asked him what kind of message that should send to educators and to policymakers.
I think that the big issue is whether it's permanent or not. If it's a temporary blip because of some particular test, then maybe it's not a big message. But if it is a movement of the educational system, it should be something that's paid attention to. It's a worrisome thing because it'll have long-run ramifications for Ireland.
And worrying is one thing, but what can people do as a response to it if it was something that was more long-term?
Well, this is the question that every country in the world is facing. How do we improve our schools? To me, there's only one single answer, and that is improve teacher quality. Now, that having been said, it's not easy. You can't just legislate from the Capitol that we want high-quality teachers. You have to think about ways of getting them in. And there, people are experimenting with a variety of different programs and policies to try to improve teacher quality.
You've calculated the effect of a good school system on the health of a country's economy. What did you find?
Well, these international tests are real. They measure skills that have long-term implications for economies. What I've looked at is how growth rates of national economies are related to these test scores. And what you find are extraordinary numbers of the power of improved performance as measured by these tests on economic growth.
And correlation doesn't always mean causation. So which happens first? Is it that a country that's generally going well will generally lead to produce students who are high achievers, or is it the high achievers that come before the country doing well?
Well, that's a very good question. The issue of causation is key to all of this. In fact, many macroeconomists don't pay any attention to these models because they're worried about whether they're causal or not. I've actually spent a lot of time with my colleague Ludger Wussmann at the University of Munich trying to test whether this is a causal relationship. What we actually do is try to rule out other possible explanations. Is it that countries that grow fast are richer, they spend more on schools, and that leads to higher achievement? No. What we find is that there's very little relationship between spending at the national level and performance on these tests. We look at some other ways to try to separate out culture and economic institutions and other factors that might influence these tests and growth at the same time. And all of the things we do suggest that this is a causal relationship. That having been said, there's still a lot of uncertainty because there's still, it's hard to say how close is Ireland to the U.S. in some economic or intellectual sense. And so the ultimate answer is, if you don't believe it's causal, why don't you cut our estimates in half? And if you cut our estimates in half, you find that the impact of moving up to, say, the level of Germany for Ireland would completely take care of your current economic problems and your banking problems.
You're saying that if we could achieve at the level that their students achieve, that would fix our economy.
That's exactly what I'm saying, over the long run. So these are stories about what happens over the next 50 years as opposed to the next 2 years. But they're ones that say that higher performance on these tests leads to higher growth rates in the future, but enough higher that it is extraordinarily important for countries to take these into account.
And isn't that part of the problem with this kind of a study, that it's to know how far ahead you can look, and that, you know, when you change a policy, it's not going to have an immediate effect, if it will have any effect at all?
Well, this is both an analytical problem, knowing how you should relate tests and policies to future economic conditions. But I think it, more than that, it's a political economy question, because most politicians, if they do something that's good, will be out of office before they get the full impact of these good policies. So the concern is always that politicians will overemphasize things about today and underemphasize the long run. The counter to that, of course, is that politicians across Europe pay a lot of attention to global warming, which by all accounts is a much longer term issue than whether we can get the Irish economy growing better over the next 40 years.
And is there any way that you can be more precise about measuring the length of time it takes for a particular policy to yield dividends?
No, because we actually don't have good information on that. What we do know is that in the long run, there are very large gains, so that 25 PISA points, which probably mean things to your readers now, is equivalent to something like 0.5% higher long-run growth rates. 0.5% higher long-run growth has overwhelming importance for economies.
Another area of interest for you is teacher salaries and conditions. How would you go about setting teacher salaries in a given country from an economic perspective?
The big problem that almost every country in the world faces today is that salaries of teachers are unrelated to how effective they are in the classroom. And when you pay people that's not related to what you care about, presumably effectiveness in the classroom you care about, you end up without the right group of people in the classrooms. You encourage some people who shouldn't be in the classrooms to stay, and you discourage others that should stay in the classroom from a societal point of view to leave. So for me, we should in general pay lots more for our most effective teachers, because we want to do everything we can to keep them in the classroom. But we should also include the zero option. We should include the fact that some people just shouldn't be in the classroom and they should be getting zero pay, not no bonus.
So how do you reward teachers then for performance in a way that is transparent and fair?
Well, this is the issue that is being discussed throughout the United States and throughout many countries. I think that the very best and the very worst teachers in any country, in any school you go into in the world, can readily be identified, and people would agree to that. It's whether you can develop an evaluation system that also links that to personnel policies that people will accept. And that's the battle that was going on when the teachers in Chicago, Illinois, went on strike last fall. It was all about evaluations. My colleague from Mexico discusses the fact that when teacher evaluations are discussed, that the teachers put on black hoods and walk around with baseball bats. This is a serious issue of trying to find ways to bring in evaluation. What we've been doing in a number of places in the United States that I think is encouraging is working on both using information about student performance as part of the indication of how well teachers are doing, and combining that with more accurate, objective, observational information of trained evaluators who come in and rate the quality of teachers.
And have you seen this working well anywhere?
Well, the place where I think it's working the best right now is Washington, D.C. In Washington right now, they have for 3 years been using an evaluation system that includes value-added information, the additions to test scores of teachers with trained evaluator information. They have a contract now that everybody has agreed to that says if you're at the top of the rating system for 2 years in a row, you can get very large bonuses in your base salary. So your base salary can go up in Washington, D.C. by some $25,000 per year. The average is probably around $60,000 or $65,000 a year. So you're talking about very significant changes. And they also, if you're on the bottom, you get fired. They have now rewarded close to 1,000 teachers, not all at that high level, but rewarded them for doing well. And they've fired close to 500 teachers at this point on the basis of the evaluations and how well teachers are doing in the classroom.
And politically, that must be very difficult.
Well, this has been a long battle in Washington, D.C. You may have heard of Michelle Rhee, who was the chancellor in Washington, D.C. She was the one who got into huge fights with the unions, and she left office in part because the mayor of Washington, D.C. got voted out of office. That might have been related to the school situation. She left Washington, D.C., but as she was leaving, everybody signed this contract. So yes, it's politically difficult. It takes a long time and a lot of work, but it looks like it could be potentially worth it.
We had a situation in Ireland when the country was first founded where the government tried to revive the Irish language by paying teachers extra for doing well, if their students did well in Irish. Many people would argue that ultimately that is what was the death knell for the language, because what happened was teachers who wanted to make more money taught Irish to the exclusion of other subjects partly, and also used very harsh methods because this was in the era of corporal punishment. Isn't that a strong argument against payment by results?
Well, I'm not for beating students. I'll say that at the beginning. I think that all pay for results and accountability systems more broadly for schools open the possibility that people behave in ways you don't want them to, that there are unintended results that are not what you desire. And so it takes time and effort to fine-tune and make sure that you're getting more of the things you want and less of the things that you don't want. People who don't like accountability in general, for example, point to the fact that with test-based accountability in some places in the U.S., there's been cheating on the test, or there might be narrowing of the curriculum, as you discuss with teaching the Irish language. There are ways to get around those things.
What are they?
Well, if I were doing test-based accountability and had control over it, I would make all the tests openly available to everybody. I would have, for example, if I wanted to know how well people were doing at fourth-grade mathematics, I would make publicly available 2,000 fourth-grade mathematics questions that I was going to randomly choose from every year, and I would allow teachers to teach to those tests because they cover the material that I want them to know. And I would randomly make them available to cut down on cheating. And so, I mean, there are obvious things that we could do if we wanted to, but often this is part of the politics, that people resist doing these things because they really don't want to push in those directions.
Another risk is that a lot of the work on terms of accountability and in terms of testing takes place in the subjects of maths and science and reading. And that omits teachers maybe who are strong performers on teaching subjects like the arts or history, geography or languages. And also maybe doesn't acknowledge a teacher who boosts children's confidence or is there with a child at a, you know, provides consolation at a time of difficulty. How would you respond to that criticism, or how would you build that into an accountability system?
Well, there are, of course, possibilities of narrowing of the curriculum and a variety of other things that we don't like, because we do have schools doing a broad range of things. And we have teachers doing more things than just teaching their class. They're interacting with other teachers and doing other activities. So you would not want to rely entirely on any test-based accountability system, I don't think. And people who favor some elements of test-based accountability, of which I'm one, would not call for that as the exclusive way to judge teachers or schools, but we would want to have a broader way. That includes bringing in these outside evaluators who can, in fact, assess a broader range of things. It would include, to me, allowing principals a say in the evaluation of teachers. It would include allowing other teachers to have a say in the valuations of teachers.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. So you'd almost be aiming for more of a team approach to the provision of teaching in the whole school then.
Absolutely. And so the other teachers in the school are contributing, and it's hard to have direct measures of how well they're doing, but they're obviously contributing, and they, the history teacher presumably has some influence on the reading teacher, and vice versa. So you have some measures of them.
How important from an economics perspective is a school principal?
Well, we've just recently started to look at school principals and find that they're very, very important in the U.S. We looked at all of the principals in the state of Texas for a 5 or 6 year period and found that they had a huge impact on the achievement gains of kids in their schools. And the best principals got really much larger gains than would be expected in their schools, and the worst principals got a lot worse. And so all of a sudden, I've changed my own view on the basis of this research to think that leadership and principals and management is really an important element that we have to pay attention to.
And how did the most effective principals exert their influence?
Well, we only have indirect evidence at this time. We're trying to find ways to go further. But it appears that successful principals managed to change the teaching force to some extent. They managed to either get rid of the worst teachers or bring in good teachers, and they led to turnover in grades that weren't doing very well. So it suggests that one of the elements is that principals influence who's teaching in the school. Now, that's probably a very narrow view of what principals do. There's more about providing instructional leadership and a variety of other things. But it does look like influencing the teaching force is an element.
From the heart of the city, 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
What do we know about the ideal class size from an economics perspective?
Well, this has been highly debated, of course, because it relates to the working conditions for teachers and principals and to the expense of schools. As I look at the evidence, the influence of class size is very small, at least relative to differences in the effectiveness of teachers. Teachers are much, much more important, or teacher quality, than class size, so that small changes in class size are virtually unseen by most teachers, and yet they have a huge influence on the cost of schools and minimal influence on student performance. The only evidence that's always pointed to is one class size experiment, Project STAR, that was conducted in the United States in the mid-1980s, and it suggested that some very large changes in class size had an impact on students in kindergarten and possibly grade one, but not after that. So there's a little bit of evidence that people want to point to if they want to argue for smaller class sizes. I personally think it's a bad economic choice to make, because I would rather take the added funds that would go into class size reduction and put them toward highly effective teachers.
So you would rather pay effective teachers more and have them teaching bigger classes rather than reducing pay and having smaller classes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the secret is, you can ask any parent who walks into a school and ask the parent, would you rather have a really good teacher with a large class or a mediocre teacher with a small class? And there's no question about what parents choose.
If you want to challenge disadvantage in a country, what's the best way to target resources to minimize the impact on the most vulnerable students and even to enhance their prospects?
Well, the only thing you can do, in my opinion, in the schools is pay attention to the quality of teachers that they're assigned, so that you want to make sure that the vulnerable populations have good and effective teachers. The second thing you can do is to worry about early education and bringing kids into schools better prepared, because this is really something that operates more on disadvantaged families than on advantaged families. Middle-class parents spend a lot of time educating their kids, and on average, less advantaged parents don't spend as much time. So if you can provide a way, an institutional way, to in fact help out disadvantaged kids before they get to school, that does a lot. Once you get into schools, you don't want to get into an explicit trade-off between, I'm going to take the good teachers and take them away from the middle-class kids and give them to the disadvantaged kids, because you end up with conflicts in your schools that aren't very healthy. You can improve the overall quality of teachers and improve everybody's achievement. It might not close achievement gaps, but everybody is better off.
Is it the case in your work that you take a kind of a neutral view with regard to what an effective teacher does, that it's more you're interested in the outcomes and the outputs of an effective teacher?
Absolutely. The biggest area of educational research in general is what makes for an effective teacher. And I think that research has uniformly been pretty disappointing, in the sense that it has not been able to identify systematic characteristics of teachers that we can change, that we could educate or provide professional development for, or what have you. So from my standpoint, at least from my own work and my own thinking about policy, I just want to avoid trying to guess at what makes for a good teacher and pay attention to who does a good job and who doesn't.
One of the things in the United States is that education is very much a local endeavor, whether it's, you know, in districts and states. What do you learn about education by looking across school performance right across the United States?
One of the things that we've learned is that it's not just a matter of resources provided to schools, that we have some very good schools that have low spending in them, and we have some very bad schools that have high spending in them, and that that's not what's driving it. We are getting some added information about when and how more school choice pays off. We have charter schools in the United States that provide parents an option of where their children go to schools. Some of them do well, some do badly. We're starting to learn more about when they do well and when they don't. And those are the kinds of things we're learning.
Finally, Eric, we don't have a great tradition in Ireland of studying the combination that you study of economics and education. If you were to make a pitch to study the economics of education, what would it be?
Well, the first thing is that we have conclusive evidence that education is extraordinarily important for economic outcomes for both individuals and for nations. And so it's an important topic, is issue one. The second thing on the other way around is that Right now, it's hard to see areas of economics that have a bigger payoff in terms of finding things that are important for both intellectual development, but for policy purposes. And so people who are working on the economics of education find that there are politicians and policy makers and decision makers that are actually reading their work, not just other economists who are into the weeds about what the analysis is all about.
And that was Professor Eric Hanischek from Stanford University. And if you found what Professor Hanischek had to say interesting on the topic of economics and education, you can read several of his papers on his website. And the address for that is hanischek.stanford.edu. Again, that's Hanischek, and he spells his name hanushek.stanford.edu. And you'll find lots of resources there for the topic of economics and education, including many of the papers that he has written on teachers' wages and on comparing performance across countries from an economic perspective. Well, that's about it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programs on our website, insideed.com, or on iTunes. You can email me. My email address is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That's insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks again to this week's guest, Professor Harry Kanishek from Stanford University. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.